Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
Regardless of the intentions of the parties in conflict, war has always been cruel and complicated. It has always counted innocent people among its victims and pulled some otherwise peace-loving souls into mortal combat. But at least in the past, war ended. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In the 21st century, many career service members cycle on and off overseas deployments for years at a time, alternating incredibly stressful postings in hostile country with time back home in the U.S., where many civilians seem unaffected by U.S. military engagement, if not almost unaware of the battles their peers are fighting abroad. As a civilian professor of English at the United States Military Academy at West Point, Elizabeth Sammet has taught many young soldiers whose futures promise a career of military leadership and also the experience of being, as we'll discuss, war commuters. Her new book is called No Man's Land, Preparing for War and Peace in Post-9/11 America. Before we welcome her, we'll make clear that any opinions Elizabeth Sammet will express today are her own and do not necessarily represent those of West Point, the U.S. Army, or the Department of Defense. Elizabeth, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you again, Chris.
We're caught as a society in a strange moment, not fully at war, not entirely at peace now or for the foreseeable future. There are no strangers kissing in Times Square. How do we define victory in modern military conflict?
I think it's almost impossible if we think about historical measures, flag raisings and peace treaties and those definitive moments, those definitive battles that change the course of history. And this is a war that has none of those markers, none of those punctuation marks. And I think it's very difficult psychologically as well as politically to think about how and in what way it could possibly end.
I was thinking even of people who are dealing like with a chronic illness, knowing that it may come back at any moment. It sounds in some ways like that's what these service members are dealing with. They are home for now. Things seem okay, but they recognize that at any moment they could be back.
I hadn't thought of that analogy before, but it makes a lot of sense to me in that it's constantly weighing on a service member's mind in terms of how long one will be at home until the next deployment. And I've learned to think of this. Another analogy that I use is that of the war commuter, which was suggested to me really by many of my conversations with former students and with my friends and colleagues in uniform who felt that going back and forth, as one called it, on a transatlantic hop seemed more normal than being at home.
And of course, if you're commuting back and forth, there's a possibility that what feels more important, more real to you is the conflict, is the war.
I think in many ways the urgency of the combat zone and the sense of a need to be vigilant all the time makes that a real and forceful presence in the mind, and it's also one that's hard, I think, to step away from when one comes home, in that if you know you're going to be at home only for a limited time, it's hard to sort of ease back into civilian life. All of the challenges of coming home in earlier wars, I think, meant that people may have taken a long time to readjust, but they didn't necessarily feel that sort of Damocles above them waiting to go back.
This is really interesting. Because our leave-taking from war now does not necessarily come with a decisive change in the places we've sent our military, service members have to find meaning in what they're doing as individuals. You point out that this is in keeping with a way of understanding war that dates back at least to Homer.
Well, I do think that this sort of new model of a kind of an idea of in some minds, a kind of perpetual conflict, which is really a sort of ancient notion when it felt very normal for everyone to be at war all the time. And then in the modern age, we began to feel that war was abnormal. And now it seems in some ways to be normalized again, to become a kind of routine. And I think that that is very much at odds with our modern sensibilities. But it's a fact of life that many have had to reckon with. And I think the other challenge is that as the military downsizes and as we enter this sort of quasi-post-war phase, although always with conflict simmering and new conflict. Every time we think it's over, it sort of bubbles up again. I think the challenge will also be in finding meaningful service in other contexts, and no one really knows exactly what that's going to look like.
There are surely benefits to modern technology and the kind of contact that it allows soldiers to have with loved ones back home. But that clear dividing line even between the two worlds of war versus peace has vanished.
Yes, I think that is another complicating factor to all of this. In addition to the routine of going back and forth between home and war, there's also that ever-present contact, be it through phone or Skype or email or something like that. I'm thinking of the scenes in the movie American Sniper where the Chris Kyle is using his satellite phone to talk to his wife in the middle of a mission, which seems to me rather improbable, but it nevertheless suggests that there is a possible immediate contact when one is in a war zone. And I think that that complicates all sorts of things. A few of my friends have suggested that it's hard sometimes to focus, to be in two worlds at once. So all of the sort of everyday significant challenges of families and children is weighing on their minds at the same time as they're trying to figure out their missions and figure out their immediate concerns.
And I guess it goes the other way, too. One can be home, but in frequent contact with buddies that we still care about that are in harm's way.
Right. And that gives, on the one hand, a great sense of comfort. One of the richest and most unexpected aspects of my career at West Point has been able to keep in touch with so many former students and colleagues when they're in the middle of a war zone. And it was a very strange phenomenon when it first happened to me, when I first got one of those messages. But now it's normal. And I value those correspondences a great deal. It also plunges one into confusion sometimes, a kind of war vertigo, as I call it in the book, in the sense that your imaginative life can be, at least in my case, very far from my daily travels and daily activities.
How do you understand your role in corresponding with your former students? Do you think of yourself as just a friend, just someone who is suggesting things to read? Do you think of yourself in a way as being a kind of sounding board or even a counselor for these students who need someone to vent to?
Maybe sometimes a little bit of each. I think often in many cases, I'm not surprised by those students who contact me. They're ones I've been close with and worked with at school. And then there are others who just have gotten in touch with me because maybe they've read something I've written or they're very keen to read some of the things that they maybe didn't have time to read while they were students. And so I've developed all sorts of new correspondences as a result of that. And often those start out with book suggestions or with questions about what students at West Point currently are reading. But then it develops in all sorts of different directions. And I like to think that it's very uncensored on their side. Maybe they can talk to me about things that they might not be able to talk to their families about. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, that teacher-student relationship evolves into a friendship, I hope. And I think that it's wonderful that has been able to evolve. And it's very much always a conversation threaded with books and movies and all sorts of cultural artifacts that my correspondents and I hold dear.
You write about, I think it's your father, right, coming home at the end of World War II. He's able to call home for the first time. His parents don't even recognize his voice.
Right. He came home. He had obviously his only contact had been through occasional letters. He had been in different bases in the United States and then in India during the war. And he came home to Fort Devens in Massachusetts, and they let him call when he got home, and his father answered the phone. And he said to him, "This doesn't sound like Teddy." And my dad said, "What are you? You're kidding me, right?" And then he took the train into Boston, I think, and came home that next day, and went to buy a suit, which I think is probably a typical thing that returning servicemen did, tells me that he didn't recognize the guy who stared back at him in the mirror in his suit. Mm.
What was his reintegration into civilian life like, and how did that compare given the time with what your former students cope with?
For him, I think there were certainly challenges. He had graduated from high school, and he was working when he enlisted. And he came home, and he knew he had to get a job. He also desperately wanted to go to school, and it was the GI Bill that let him do that. So he went to school, and then he went to law school. I think in many ways serving in the Army changed his life, because I don't think these were things that he was very much a Depression-era child, and these were things that he probably wouldn't have been able to do without that. And I'm sure it changed him in other ways as well. As I note that it does my students, that experience makes people grow up in all sorts of different ways.
There have always been domestic postings, right? You could be in the military and serve in any state or, you know, somewhere in the United States. But now, because of things like drone technology, you can, like, work a kind of 9-to-5 military job. You can drive home every night to a very civilian-like home and still be directly involved with the action of war.
I think that that kind of technology is really forcing us to change the way we think about conflict, the way we think about violence and our proximity to it. And I think there are studies that suggest that the levels of stress faced by people who do work in those jobs that are a 9-to-5 remote operators of various technologies. And I think it will cause us really to reimagine, as will the realm of cyber and cyber warfare, which is very much on the minds of policymakers right now. It requires us maybe to develop new vocabularies, and also change our assumptions about what war does to people.
At least if you are fighting for, as you know, the trope goes, the guy in the foxhole next to you, or the gal. There is that sense that you are bonded in this thing, even when maybe the politics don't make sense or don't seem obvious to you. It's got to be harder to do that when you are doing things that are dangerous but involve very little physical risk to you, for example, using something like drone technology. Have your students struggled with that concept, or do they have another way of finding their way to feeling that what they are doing is right and justifiable?
I think, at least in terms of the culture of the Army and of West Point, the idea of proximity to violence is what students wrestle with first and foremost. And I think that's a contrast perhaps to other services. I know that in speaking with students at the Air Force Academy, part of what is important to them is realizing that they may be inflicting violence from a great distance, and that it's always important for them to understand that there are human beings involved and not to allow their moral sense to be dulled by distance. I think with my students, it's the idea of physical proximity that really shapes their understanding. Now, whether they will serve in those capacities or not in the ensuing years is, of course, a question that they face when they choose their branch, what area they will work on in the Army in future.
We're speaking this hour with Elizabeth Sammet, professor of English at the United States Military Academy at West Point and author of a new book called No Man's Land, Preparing for War and Peace in Post-9/11 America. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Elizabeth Stammett, who's professor of English at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Her new book is called No Man's Land, Preparing for War and Peace in Post-9/11 America. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We know what it means to prepare for war, or we think we do. What do you mean when you say prepare for peace?
Well, sometimes I phrase it to my students in the sense that I'm trying to prepare them for the inevitability of their own unpreparedness. So that there will always be some moment, despite all the doctrine they've memorized, all the rules and regulations, all the books they've read, all the conversations we've had, where they will feel unprepared. And I think that that kind of flexibility in response to that is something that I'm trying to make them aware of and make them think about. And so when I say prepare for peace, I mean that they have to imagine, as I suggested before, a world that looks very different to the one that the institution, and by that I mean West Point and the military more largely, has been thinking about and preparing for the last 15 years now, 14, 15 years. I think it's very hard for students who are focused on the near term, obviously for good reasons. They're 19, 20 years old, and they're very concerned about what their first experience will be like as lieutenants. But there will be a time when they're asked to do things that don't look like war at all, and they need to be able to bring the same acumen and the same focus and concentration to those activities, even if they can't quite imagine them yet.
What are you thinking about as you're designing your classes with regard to your role as a person who teaches these young men and women to write their own stories, and if not, you know, literally do so, to sort of understand their lives and put them in some kind of context that they can live with?
Well, they inherit, obviously the military is rich in tradition, and they inherit so many different stories. They inherit ancient stories about war and peace. They inherit local lore from West Point and the Army. And so, in a sense, they're bombarded with other people's stories. And one of the things I think that any college education should provide, and that the preparation of young men and women for commissioned service in the Army, what that institution needs to provide is a way for them to figure out their own stories. Because I think that given the unsettled nature of our world, given the fact that many of the things they'll be engaged in don't conform to those old stories, they need to figure out how to write new ones, how to weave new ones. And even if that doesn't happen for them in the service, it will happen one day whenever they put the uniform away and embark again on another career. And I think it's very hard sometimes. I've watched some of my colleagues go through that transition. And if they haven't sort of figured out who they are and what they want to be beyond the uniform, then sometimes I think a belated moment of crisis can come.
And, of course, there's the fact that the rest of the culture is trying to write stories, sometimes out of the best possible intentions. But you write about your concern that the American soldier has been reduced to little more than a caricature. We're happy to, like, buy them drinks or give up our seats on airplanes. We find it harder as a culture to look deeply and honestly at how the experiences of active duty military personnel are going to shape them long after they come home.
Yes, I think we like to put them in one category or another, so that on the one hand, everyone's a hero. We thank veterans for their service. We thank active duty military for their service. And then we move on in the course of our daily round. On the other hand, we hold up an image of the veteran irrevocably scarred internally or externally. And I think in a sense, we pathologize that veteran. I think we inherited that from the Vietnam era. And I think that what's necessary is to normalize the relation between civilians and the military. And I think we have a long way to go before we can figure out how to do that.
I wonder if it was easier to do. I imagine it was easier to do when it wasn't an all-volunteer military, when it was likely that literally every family had sent a son to war.
I think, yes, when the rhetoric of the citizen soldier was paramount, and when millions and millions and millions of people entered the service, I think that it seemed far less alien than it does today to many Americans.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Ron on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Ron.
Hello. My question is, during the Vietnam War, there were B-52 pilots who, to all intents and purposes, fought drone warfare. They would get up in the morning, they'd kiss their wives goodbye, they'd drive to the office, have a briefing, climb in their aircraft, fly, drop their payloads, and be home in time again for cocktails at the O Club and dinner. How has anyone talked to or studied how they dealt with the stresses of being a part of that and yet separated from it?
I'm not sure that I know particular studies or literature on that subject. I do think that now when military culture and I think American culture is much more open to talking about these issues, that I think perhaps that will lead to more studies, and there may be some out there already.
You write about returning to Catch-22, Joseph Heller's novel, after having read it, I guess, some decades before, and then having not really gone back to it in a while. Can you talk about what drew you back to the novel and what it meant to you when you reread it?
Sure. When I first read it, I had just come from graduate school to join the West Point faculty, and I read it, and its absurdist, obvious absurdist quality was amazing to me, and I sort of found analogs to all of the outrageous characters and people that I had met, and sometimes in the rules and regulations I encountered and the vocabulary used to describe things, I just thought it was absolutely hilarious. And the serious undercurrent, the scene to which the novel returns over and over again, which is Yossarian in the plane trying to keep alive one of his another member of the crew who has been shot and who will ultimately die. I had somehow, in reading it, those moments somehow I didn't focus on them. I didn't really think a lot about them, and I instead dwelled on the humor. And then I tried, after we went to war and after a lot of things had changed for me about my own relationship to the institution, I tried to read it again, and I always got hung up on that scene in the plane. And I thought, this isn't funny at all, and I don't know how I ever thought it was. And I kept coming back, and it didn't work. And then finally I did. Finally, after I had lost people who were close to me, and I read it again, and I saw a lot of the horror in it as well. There were still moments that were funny, and I think many people who have seen horrible things in combat also have seen sort of absurdist, humorous moments as well, and it's an awkward, weird combination. And so I finally came back to it, and it meant something very different to me, and I realized that Heller had captured a lot more than the sort of outrageous military caricatures on my first reading.
How has your relationship to the institution, and by that I guess you mean West Point, but the military in general, changed over the course of the years that you've been teaching at West Point, which track pretty closely to the post 9/11 years?
Right. I first came to West Point in 1997, and I spent my first few years there just learning about a new culture and trying to immerse myself in it and trying to understand it. And then I think over the years there's been a sort of serial revision. So when we first went to war, I defined my job for myself as preparing my students for war. And I told this narrative to myself. I was persuaded by it. I thought, okay, we used to be at peace, now we're at war, and so we have to prepare students for war. And I persuaded myself of that narrative for a very long time until I realized that it wasn't so simple as that, complicated though that may be on its own, but that it was really about preparing people to go back and forth. And what did that look like? And preparing people to wrestle with complexities and ambiguities that smooth and simple arc from peace to war really didn't accommodate anymore.
I think it's really interesting that you take us in the book through the ways that you've wrestled with the fact that if you didn't work at West Point, you might be like a lot of the rest of America, to the extent that it would be easier for you not to sort of dwell on the experiences of our service members.
I think it would be remarkably easy, and I have to remember that all the time when I think about civil-military relations and I think about attitudes toward veterans and I think about service members' attitudes toward civilians. Had I taught English somewhere else, except perhaps for, depending on the institution, had there been ROTC students or veterans on the new GI Bill who had returned, I just don't think I would have encountered them. And so I think it would have felt all very strange and very distant to me.
What's the balance among faculty members at West Point between civilian and military faculty members?
We have just over 20% civilians, between 20 and 22, I think.
And
the rest are military.
Does there feel like there is a division of some kind?
Between civilians and military
faculty,
at West Point itself?
Yeah.
I think clearly that everyone there, no matter whether they wear a uniform or not, is invested in the particular mission of the place, no matter whether they teach physics or English or a foreign language, I think, or whether they wear a uniform or not. I think there's an inescapable sense that when one teaches there, one commits to something beyond that discipline. And I think that there may be different perspectives, different political perspectives, and these cross, you know, uniform or not. There may be different attitudes toward the best way to prepare our students for what lies ahead. But I do sense that there is a commitment that transcends particular divisions and boundaries in the constituencies.
Based on what you do for a living and your embrace of literature and the power of literature, I know that you want your students to think very critically and deeply about their lives and about what they do and about their impact on the world. And it sounds very much like many of them absolutely fulfill this hope of yours. At the same time, you also know that you're preparing them to do a job where there's only like certain times when you can really question what you've been told to do.
Absolutely. I think that that's a tension and a challenge that cadets at West Point learn almost immediately. There are parts of their day in which it's not about reflection. It's about executing whatever order is given. And then they might be thrown the next hour into my class where I start asking them what they think about things. And it takes a while to figure that out and to figure out when it is appropriate and when it is not. But the other part to that is that they can never turn off that moral sense. They can never afford to surrender their judgment, because even an order needs to be lawful. Even an order needs to be processed. And so it's I think, vital to remember as part of their preparation for being officers that they always need to retain that. And it's sometimes a real struggle. It's hard to reflect, especially when one knows that they have committed to an often bloody and destructive business, and that's despite all the romance that sometimes attaches to military service, there is an inescapable brutality, and the wars have brought that home to them and to us.
Your students are surely the creme de la creme, but I wonder if you have a sense that over the years there at West Point, some of them come to a better understanding of what they've signed themselves up for than they had at, 17 or 18 as brand new recruits?
Oh, I think they absolutely do. I think many people, and I'm thinking here not only of cadets but of colonels of my acquaintance who went to West Point many years ago. A lot of people come to West Point or to another service academy for particular reasons, and they stay for different ones. Because when you're 18, you have certain notions about your life and about service and about what you want to do. But I think that some of those go away and they're replaced by more mature commitments. And so I think that's often the case, that people will tell you they went to West Point for one reason and ended up staying 30 years later in the Army for radically different ones they never anticipated.
It has to be strange to you realizing that somewhere in, the many classrooms of students you've taught are individuals who will go on to very prominent positions within the military, just statistically based on where they're going to school and the kinds of careers they can be expected to have.
Yes, I have a friend, in fact, and there probably there's more than one faculty member who does this, but he'll often look out at his class and tell them that the future chairman of the Joint Chiefs right. might be in this classroom. Look around. And that's certainly on my mind in the sense that, again, this is a sense about the short view and the long view, that our immediate concern is to prepare second lieutenants. But all along, I think that we also need to think about preparing them for a lifetime of service in uniform or out, and that requires different skills, that requires strategic thinking as well as a tactical grasp of the situation.
How does the material you teach, the specific readings that you assign, change from year to year?
I have certain texts that I often go back to, and it doesn't matter whether we're engaged in peace or war or what. There are also other changes that I've made, not necessarily to look at particular regions of the world, although sometimes a text about Afghanistan, for example, or about the Middle East seems to me not only to answer my requirements for a rich literary text, but also might have a geographical or topical connection. But I think that I look now for texts that exercise certain faculties in my students. And so those texts vary widely, but ask them to wrestle with ambiguity, challenge perhaps some of their notions about all of the different archetypes we've inherited from cultural works from the ancient Greeks on.
We're speaking this hour with Elizabeth Stammett. She's professor of English at the United States Military Academy at West Point and author of a new book called No Man's Land, Preparing for War and Peace in Post-9/11 America. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Elizabeth Stammett, who teaches English at the United States Military Academy at West Point and has just published a new book called No Man's Land, Preparing for War and Peace in Post-9/11 America. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Pam, who writes, "I, as a vet, can tell you the most difficult thing I have to explain to civilians is that most of what they think about the military is inaccurate. I hope that in the future a more realistic picture of not just who is in the military, but also what we do will emerge." Is this a common frustration, Elizabeth, with your students and former students?
I think it is, in that we get so much now of our sense of who's in the military and what they're all about from pop culture, from movies, which perform all sorts of distortions. Many of the sort of everyday, difficult but less exciting tasks of military service aren't really fodder for Hollywood movies or for bestsellers. And so I do think the actual, the rigorous training, the wide array of areas of expertise that the particular jobs that service members do aren't really widely known.
I think Americans understood in the fallout after the Vietnam War that regardless of our opinion politically about the moral justifiability of the war, that we should not hold accountable the service members who were called to fight. And it's something that people have tried very hard not to do in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. at the same time, there are people who sort of struggle with whether these are essentially good and right conflicts or bad and flawed conflicts, and there are still, you know, service members attached to these things. How much are people serving in the military affected by the idea that people want to honor their service but may think that they are there for the wrong reasons?
I think probably that whole conversation is complicated by the all-volunteer force.
Yeah.
So I think there is also a strain that may be this sense that, well, they volunteered for this, and so there's a sense in which civilians have almost wholly disconnected, in a sense, from the purposes and from the use of force in all of our names. We somehow feel that we've outsourced it in a way. And I don't even know. I've spoken to many people, for example, who one friend who protested the Vietnam War on the New Haven town green, and then many years later protested the Iraq War. And she looked around and there were about five people with her, all of whom had been with her decades before. But it just wasn't the same level of investment. I think the idea of not caring one way or another seems to be, and ignoring the whole conflict seems in many ways to be the most frustrating aspect. There's a sort of apathy, really, and not from the first, and not really a sharp interrogation of causes and reasons and what it means to send people to fight in our name.
How much do you think about the fact that you may also be preparing your students for the possibility that they could die at a very young age or could be grievously wounded at a very young age?
I think that the question of mortality is difficult for 18-year-olds.
And not just
18-year-olds.
Right.
I think that they have that sense of invincibility, and I think they share that with many of their civilian colleagues. But I do think when we encounter it in literature or when we encounter wounds, I've just been reading the Iliad with my freshmen, that these things matter to them in a different way because their own imagining of their futures is very different from someone who chooses another profession. That isn't to say there aren't other professions that are intimately connected with life and death, but I think all of those professions require some studied and focused attention on what is, you know, the most difficult question.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Mike in Waxahachie. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Two quick questions. Could you name some of the books that is required reading in her class? And also, I understand why Nixon abolished the draft, and I know it probably won't happen, but does she have an opinion on reinstituting the draft?
Thanks for your call.
As to the first question, Mike, the required reading changes over the years, but I can name some sort of old standbys. I always like to teach, especially for my freshmen, some plays of Shakespeare. I like to go back in time to look at ancient texts like Homer's epics or Virgil's epic, in that they give us some of the military archetypes that we are still influenced by, even if we don't always know where they came from. And then I like to do some contemporary literature as well, and that ranges from novels to films. I teach a film course to poetry and drama. And as to the question of the draft, a lot of people talk about instituting some kind of national service that is perhaps reaches beyond pure military service. I think politically right now, I can't see that they will bring back a draft unless there is some existential threat to the nation. But in the absence of that, I think one of our great challenges is to figure out how to see a way forward, how to see a way to invest the civilian population in the wars we fight.
How much thought do you give to deliberately assigning reading that has been written by women?
I try to give as broad broad a range of literature as I can. I think that assigning literature by women is important to that range, and the ideas of women about war, I think, are hugely important, and I think increasingly we will find that women's relationship to war, which has been, of course, conventionally anyway, the attitude of those women sort of representing those on the home front. But increasingly, that is not the case. And so I think that in order to give my students, men and women both, as rich a sense of the relationship of men and women to war, that assigning as broad a range of reading as I can is essential.
I'm really interested in the fact that you mentioned that you also teach a film class, because not that Hollywood can't get things right, but sort of by its nature, a cinematic depiction of anything is going to be different than the real thing and yet feel very real to an audience. And I wonder what you've been drawn to over the years to explore in your film class.
Well, it's sort of the flip side of what we were talking about earlier when we talked about long-distance violence, when we talked about remote-controlled drones, when the gentleman who called and talked about the B-52s. We have, together with that, we have this illusion of proximity to war, which is created by technology and by digital reproduction. And so we can put a camera on a soldier's helmet, and in a sense, go with that soldier to war. But of course, it's not the same thing, and there's all sorts of illusions and errors that come from that kind of technology. And so, using film and helping the students to understand that the photographic image may look real, but it is constructed of many different things. It has different agendas. It leaves out important factors and emphasizes others. And so we look at a broad range of films, not only those that focus on war specifically, but comedies, westerns. I start with a silent film to look at the sort of evolving technology of this great art form of the 20th and now 21st century.
When you have students who have, maintained correspondence with you after leaving, particularly during the time that they are deployed overseas in war situations, are there patterns that emerge in terms of, like, their understanding of what they're doing and how this work affects their lives and the broader world? Is there, like a series of almost steps that you can identify as they go from imagining what's ahead to living it?
I think their reactions are fairly diverse in that their experiences are so different. One may be doing a particular job at a remote outpost with a small unit. Another may be doing an office job. And so there are wildly different activities, and I think that helps to shape them. So I guess maybe the patterns have very much to do with the particular jobs. So I happen to know a lot of helicopter pilots, and they seem to have a particular sense of their own relationship to flying, to supporting ground troops. They think a lot, I think, about perspective, because it's only natural that I think aviators would think about perspective and think about their relationship to those on the ground. And so they have a kind of – that makes them often, I find, sort of very, very nuanced in their approach to distance and proximity. And then I think a lot of students, former students anyway, just feel a kind of – there's an exhilaration. There's also great disappointment. They try to find – satisfaction and fulfillment in taking care of their soldiers, of their unit, in executing their mission with great professionalism. But depending on the particular experiences they have on the ground, they also carry with them often, I think, a great sadness and increasingly sometimes a great frustration. They might have gone back, for example, to a particular region of Afghanistan and Iraq where they had been several years before, and it maybe looks totally different. And so this strange pattern of returning over and over again, I think, causes new phenomena and new stages in their understanding of warfare.
It has to be devastating to return after an absence and recognize that things are actually worse than the last time you were there.
I think it has to be an unbelievable moment to come back to that situation and to think what was all of that worth the last time, and now I have to go back here and sort of ramp up and start over. And they're so earnest and so professional that they work really hard to do that. But I think increasingly they face a really difficult challenge in that regard.
Elizabeth, do they keep writing you when they get home again?
Yes. I have lots of correspondence that goes on as those soldiers come home. Some of them stay in the Army. Some of them end up now for the first time I'm seeing former students join me on the faculty.
Hmm.
And that's really a lovely thing to teach with them and to continue that conversation about literature with them. Nothing gives me more delight than to stroll down the hall in our department and stop in a former student, now colleague's office and ask him what he's teaching that day and talk about things. And that's really a great thrill for me that they're able to pursue both their literary aspirations, their scholarly aspirations, and their military aspirations.
I don't know what percentage of the correspondence you receive is email and what percent comes on paper, but I wonder what you do with the paper documents.
I save the paper documents and the email as well. I would say there haven't been many correspondents who have been without at least intermittent email contact. But I did have one, and I used to get from him sand-filled letters from the desert in Iraq, and I still have those in a safe place.
Do you have a filing system for going back to them, because you do use them to inspire your own writing?
I do. I save them all and archive them in my email and often go back to them. And sometimes my correspondents ask to see them again. You know, they don't always remember where they were mentally at that moment. And so it's interesting sometimes for us to talk about those earlier exchanges.
It has to be very emotional to realize something they've forgotten is there.
I think it is. I think also it helps ground them. Mm-hmm. To realize they were, even under duress, that they were thoughtful, that they were reading, that they were professional and concerned about the future, their own future and the future of their soldiers.
Elizabeth Sammet is professor of English at the United States Military Academy at West Point. The things we've talked about today are her own perspectives and opinions, not those of the U.S. military. Her new book is called No Man's Land, Preparing for War and Peace in Post-9/11 America. Elizabeth, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us today.
Chris, I really appreciate it. I enjoy talking to you as always. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.